Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Kristen Naka. Kristen Naka's book, Bird Eating Bird, was the winner of the National Poetry Series and MTV U Prize. She grew up in Annandale, Virginia, and has since lived in a number of cities, including Seattle, Pittsburgh, Lincoln, Nebraska, and San Antonio, Texas. She teaches Asian American and Latino poetry at McAllister College in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Naka. How you doing?
I'm doing great, Jan. Thanks for having me.
It's great to see you again. And years ago, you did a couple guest spots as host of Prosody, so it's especially great to have you back.
Yeah, it's wonderful to be in the new studio.
Mm-hmm. New studios and with your new book. Congratulations. That's a really great accomplishment.
Thank you so much.
2008 National Poetry Series, selected by Youssef Kamanyaka.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. So, and this book just came out, and you're going to read from the book?
I will.
Okay.
So I've been living in all over the country, or kind of just drifting. So I thought I would read poems, first off, just from a bunch of different cities. And I'll start in Annandale, Virginia, where I grew up, which is the suburbs outside of Washington, D.C. And I'll go ahead and read the poem. This is called Catching Cardinals, Annandale, Virginia. For a week, he stacked dusty sacks of birdseed in a kitchen corner. And we acted like the towering stack wouldn't topple us during dinner. His booby trap, white cotton twine, a stick, and a penny put together from 2x4s and chicken wire, peeled off a thorny ream at Heckinger's. Out of nowhere, the gold-plated cage. The same gold cage where for years lived our pet cockatoo, who spent all day spitting seed husks on the furniture. Then one night, Dad cut up bread with scissors. I woke up with the smells of coffee, menthol cigarettes, and sweat burning the skin inside my nostrils. I dashed to a window to watch him and my brother. In a shallow slant in the yard, they hid out, ready to rip the cord and walk away, red bird in hand. They chased blue jays with rocks. Swarms descended. I heard the screen door snap. I still picture streaks of blood down his arms from wrestling blackbirds from his trap. It took days for Dad to capture his prize. Once he did, I remember I looked at this wild thing and wondered why it was so important. How it shrieked, bled, and shoved its beak through the rods into the unbound air. Uses for Spanish in Pittsburgh. What use is there for describing Bloomfield's hard sloping rooftops this way? Or that the church steeples beam upward, inexpertly toward God. What difference does it make to say the chimney pipes peel their red skins or las pieles rojas, exposing tough steel underneath? What good, then, for Spanish, its parody of consonants and vowels, vowels like a window to the throat, breath chiming through the vocal cords? And what good is singing to describe this barrio's version of the shortened sky? El cielo cortado, power lines crisscrossing so high that blue only teases through them. And what, for fog, la niebla arrastra, keeping down los calles inmóviles before the bank and grocery store open. Y por la zapatería on Liberty Avenue, a lady's antique boot for a street sign. What use to remember in any language? My father was a Puerto Rican shoe salesman. From his mouth dangled a ropey, ashy cigarette. He spoke good English and knew when to smile. With his strong fingers, he'd knot shoes like redas, knew three kinds of knots so lady customers could buy the shoes they loved to look at but really shouldn't have worn. At home, Dad kept his lengua íntima to himself, his Spanish not for children, only older relatives who forced him to speak reminded, Spanish means there's another person inside you. All beauty, he'd argue. No power in it. Still, I remember he spoke a hushed Spanish to customers who struggled in English, the ones he pitied for having no language to live on. So many years gone. What use to invent or question him in Pittsburgh? The educated one, why would I want my clumsy Spanish to stray from the pages of books outward? My tongue he'd think so untrue and inarticulate. Each word having no past in it, what then? Speaking Spanish to make them better times or Pittsburgh a better place. En vez de regresar a la dura realidad del pasado. And then if I choose to speak like this, who will listen? This poem is set in my old apartment in Lincoln, Nebraska. I'll read you the English version. It's called Not Yet. It's a poem about being able to speak and describe things in Spanish and sometimes not really having all the words. The nubs of the tongue sit fat and bulky as flowers. Say tree. What's there but bare branches and some bark? No words for putting layers of skin on spring yet. Green glows loose without its leaves. The only bird that lands there is the falcon. In the mirror, the reflection of her hair is carved chestnuts. The veins of the creek encrusted with walls. No stones. No losing. Meanwhile, your hands are made of knuckles and made of skin. In the window, glass overlaps the naked tree outside. No fingernails, just the nails. Finger claws, finger swords, she says. The laundry on the bed is clean and limp. The woman in her bed hopes she doesn't die in her sleep. Wake up. Wake up. The falcon waits for her in the naked tree, beyond the window, beyond the walls. The small bird's song overlaps the clear night, keeps her from her sleep. Still, every song he sings, he's food for the falcon. Every night she waits, she's food for death.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Kristen Naka, reading from her new book, Bird Eating Bird, winner of the National Poetry Series Prize, I want to say that, and the MTV Youth Prize. I want to ask you about the, there's such a wonderful voice in your poems, and supported by this extension of detail. A lot of your poems are two pages. There's a fullness to them that's just great. But I want to ask you about the sense of place in the poems. And you preface these few poems by talking about where you've lived, you know, many places. How do you think this moving around and these different places have affected your poems, you know, beyond the, you know, the obvious of, you know, writing poems about Pittsburgh or Nebraska, et cetera, but in terms of form or a sense of grit or voice?
I think that place affects my voice deeply. I think as a person or as a poet, when I'm composing, I'm usually in sort of a dream space and less conscious of my body. And then I have these sort of triggers to get me grounded to who I am, like the kinds of poems that I'm reading, and then just looking around and feeling the world for texture. It's sort of like I think in certain ways, the poems that I do write about are from memory or from memories, and those feel so totally indelible. But then it's really odd in your own mind, like you can't actually feel them. You know what I mean? Like you can sort of relive the events and you can even have an emotional response, but it feels awkward to not actually touch them with your fingers. And I think that's why I try to put a lot of visual clues and sensory detail into my poems because it reminds me of what it actually feels like to go through the experience or to observe something or to listen to something. Yeah, that's...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it also helps the reader a lot to to experience it. I mean, I was writing some of this down, the sense of the visceral in those poems. You have, streaks of blood from wrestling blackbirds from its trap, and then, more ordinary details like, coffee, menthol, cigarette, sweat, but it's all in there, and so that we can imagine it. I liked what you said about looking to the world for texture.
Yeah. Definitely, like, a poem is something you should be able to smell, I think. Smell is like the most intense and takes you so quickly into your memories and is the sense that it gives you the sense of something that can't really change too. You know, like we can't usually smell one thing and then wish it smelled like something else.
Well, yeah. If you describe something without smell, people could get different ideas of it.
Yeah.
But if you nail that smell, there's no.
And it's totally it's like the sense that's the love and repulsion sense. So I tell my students all the time, like, if you can't understand it, what does it smell like?
Mm-hmm.
They come up with pretty good ones.
Yeah, I bet. But yeah, I mean, whenever you pair love and repulsion, something happens.
Yeah.
Something happens, maybe not what you expected, but something does.
Yeah, and then when you're smelling the in-between, I think, is when you're – and trying to, like, describe it precisely is when you're really talking about something really in its essence. You know, like, there's the smells that we love and the smells that we hate. And if we actually, like, took a minute and, like, paid attention to, like, just the smallest grains in the air.
Mm-hmm.
That's when you're really describing something to its to its distinctiveness, I think.
So the smell is not usually described.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Could you read more poems?
Sure. Absolutely. I was traveling, and I travel back to Mexico City as much as I can. And I was studying Spanish there and just trying to take in the city. That's a city that smells like all kinds of things. And while I was there, I had a fantastic affair. And this poem, when I wrote it at first, had a happy ending. And it never really took. And finally, I had to change the ending to what really happened. Gavilán or Paloma, Mexico City. There's some Spanish in here. It's the Spanish is from the song Gavilán or Paloma by José. And the translations are, "You didn't stop staring. You alone were completely beautiful and sensual, and how I fell into your arms." Gavilán or Paloma. Once a bird pecked her lover's hand with such sincerity that she lost hold of the seeds she secretly tossed to keep all the birds at her command. "No dejabas de mirar," you sang me last night. "Estaba sola completamente bella y sensual," and the notes stirred loose feather dust from your chest. When you exhaled, your silhouette dissolved, reddening the defe dusk. Vibrato frayed your veil. How you fled one city, but betrayal beckoned you. Confess how lovers nest in branches of your collarbones while you sleep. Entre tus brazos caí, consumed by your song's lonesome downbeat. Paloma, I know some days begin with birds. Nights we suffer from too few songs. How the chorus of a woman's lips delays sorrows that each heartbeat prolongs. Amiga, tell me how you're leaning before sunlight bathes the city in pink spells. Will your voice deliver me morning, or will the caroling street vendor's bells? I'm going to take you back to where I grew up in Annandale. My mom is from the Philippines, so we slaughter a pig. whenever there's a baptism. And I think I'm under the understanding that it was the same in my father's culture in Puerto Rico. And this is about that. It's called baptism. The taller men with baseball bats, a tree branch garbled with knots, log iron, and leftover pipe from the fence they put up last summer. The shorter men gripping buck knives for slashing at the pig's neck and ripened on a dry slop of peanuts, cornflakes, and newspaper shavings, moiled between the washer and dryer and shelves of dust-caked soda bottles, the pig that grew tall enough to sniff and lick the doorknob. So from the other side I watched it turn and, hearing it flicker at night, dreamt of suckering the pig's escape. Then they unleashed it. It drubbing its blunt, fleshy hammers through the downstairs hallway, its high-pitched cough the air it dragged over vocal cord lathing. Then they prodded it across the yard and cornered it under the porch. So with a ka-thunk, the pig, then stilled in its tracks, had to watch as one of the men crept up and dragged a knife across its neck. They held the sullen body in their pink, craggy hands, standing up in order to catch its blood in a bucket. Blood mother cooked into a musty black blood food we smothered our rice in. After that, the men heaved the body on a picnic table wrapped in glad bags and tape and rolled the carcass on its back and split the skin down the long belly, its guts oozing out, all beigey, peachy, and blue like clouds of chewed bubblegum or the bulbs of a wilted, worn-in coin purse. Collapsed hoses too soft and slick to pile up, spread across the lawn in pearly pools. Then, carefully, the men excised the gallbladder before it broke and spoiled the meat. Gallbladder curled like a finger on a folding chair beside them while they emptied the carcass to the snout. On the grass, the heart and lungs lay in the throat, ridged and perfect as a staircase. And then the new backbone, a metal rod they pierced and guided through the carcass, tackle they hoisted onto some poles, so, though I can't remember exactly, they could turn the whole thing on a spit. How it hovered for hours over the orange coals that startled whenever the juices dripped and the rangy smell of singed pork meat and charcoal slinked into our sweat and the pork skin transluted, cells shimmering amber and snapping easily to the touch, hot, loosened fat down our fingers until the meat fell apart without us having to hack at it, the men smoking packs of cool cigarettes and piling up the empty Schlitz beer cans, hardly mentioning a thing about the child. In Nebraska, when I got there, I had been suffering from some traumatic foot injuries, and I was to the point where I had to spend a lot of time in bed because every time I was taking any steps, I was in a great deal of pain. And this is a villanelle about that called One Foot. Listen and you'll hear a knock. Watch the dust lift off the land. Pray I give up my Canaan walk. Some wind will tear the ears off stalks of corn. No sound eviscerates a strand. I listen close but hear no knock. Each footstep I mill bones to chalk, then sink in soot wherever I stand. I dream I give up my cane and walk. In nightmares, wispy pipe roots block the blood flow to a leaf foot, browning, orphaned on the stem. Listless, I hear the knock of the oxygen machine. The good doc strings me up a foot, leaves me bland yellow toes. Go ahead and walk, Doc says, and hacks the cast to a cock of gauze, peat hair, and loose tanned skin, nurse swabs. Like clockwork, knock gulls at my windowsill. That bad flock, the smallest sores, peak their demands. Listen, do you hear them knock? Do I pray harder? Wake up. Walk.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Kristen Naka, reading from her new book, Bird Eating Bird. There's some, you know, intensely visceral imagery, especially in the pig poem, slaughtering the pig, and but also, you know, there's a lot of hard sounds in those last poems you read. And I really admire the way, you know, you use sound to support the content here. But I wanted to ask you about the activity of not backing away from the violence, you know, of slaughter. You know, you've mentioned the word slaughter a couple of times in this interview, in which, you know, you could go for weeks and not hear that word, or months, I don't know. But I really like that you don't back away as a writer from the difficult language, but can you talk about that, those choices?
Yeah, you know, my book's called Bird Eating Bird, and I think it's the only title that suited my book. I mean, I think for the sort of metaphor of cannibalism, probably is the most appropriate one. Especially, I study a lot of different cultures or marginalized cultures' poetry, because that's sort of the tradition that I came out of. And we're always trying to exercise our voice or convince ourselves that we even have one. And I think some of it has to do with just, forces of capitalism and poverty and sort of like cultural appropriation that sort of make us feel like we're just supposed to be picked over for elements of culture, whether it's food or style, like clothing, and otherwise we don't have a voice. That and I think even just living that kind of a life where I came from a suburban area, maybe being the only sort of mixed race child too, where I just felt like my experience. Maybe I felt like it was under attack, because I really did feel like whenever I went to anyone else's home, it was like the other people that I had met who are from that place. And I had to assert my own sort of like culture or language or way of being. And so it just feels like this constant sense of either of being picked on, for one. And then I think in terms of some of the cannibalism, I guess metaphor too, probably has to do with, you know, being a lesbian and how sort of like marginalized communities or relationships that are under duress, how we treat one another. You know, I think that's sort of like the great difficulty or sadness that I can think about with my own community, is that a number of us are so traumatized. We're trying to be convinced constantly that we shouldn't be this way, and that's another sense of feeling like you're marginalized or picked on,
shouldn't be
queer.
Less, yeah,
you know, we shouldn't be queer, and we shouldn't really be different, and we shouldn't express our sexualities in a healthy way, and then we take that violence out on each other as well. I think that's maybe the core metaphor that I was working with. But okay. it certainly grounds my experience in the world.
Mm-hmm. So that's totally necessary because of all that you just talked about, to put it in, to include whatever difficult moments come up in the poems.
Yeah,
that to gloss over them, take them out, not mention them would be just another example of
just joining in, you know, or backing away from the challenge of being yourself.
Right, participating in sabotaging yourself.
Exactly, or just having yourself, like your soul sort of beaten out of you, and then just giving in because you're tired.
Good reason. Well said. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, we have time for more poems.
Okay, great. This poem is a little bit about my Filipino side of my family. I have some cousins whom I love who are Jehovah's Witnesses who live in San Francisco. And they were sort of the Americanized Filipinos that I thought were so cool when I was growing up because they grew up in Kansas. I mean, how American, how much more American can you be besides that? And then being in Pittsburgh, I just remember being in neighborhoods where the witnesses would come around and come talk to you in the morning. So it just made me think of them. So it's called Witness. My cousin Sunny missions with her kids in the Philippines. In Pittsburgh, Constance and Rayanne come to the door. We've met before at another address. Through the lead glass window, they straighten their scarves, teeth, when they hear footsteps clanging near the door. They don't remember my streamlined teeth, my globy lips or eyes, from all the heads they meet. My cousin Sonny's a witness too, I tell them. She missions with her kids in the Philippines. Down Atlantic Avenue a year before, I said, come back and meet Faith, the owner here. She's new in town and needs to make more friends. Today, they ask if I follow Faith, and I decline, an atheist, and they wring their knuckles, screw fingers around their moldy joints like nutcracker's teeth. My cousin Jing Jing, Sunny's sister, a witness too, I say, as they clang the pages of their good books, fingering for a tooth of conversation. Constance and Rayanne don't rush into talking. Mornings they buzz the doors like flies. And I'm patient with them, out of respect for the cousins, while teeming in the hot Pittsburgh dust I carry in a suitcase from home to home. Jing Jing is my favorite name, is what I long to tell them. What's your favorite name? I long to ask. Once in Seattle, I was bald and breezes slid easily from my gut. I'd say, make like the Jehovah's Witnesses and count me out. Once Sunny and Jing came out to the San Francisco airport to see Pudding and me as we stretched our good leg out to the Philippines. They kept a glowy silence about my head as we teetered past the clanging Krishnas. Love bawled through my bare skin, a brilliant passport. In the PI, Pudding and I visited Uncle Ulpiano, their father. A stroke had left a golden sore in his eye. Faith is a photo of Ulpe, a ranger in World War II, closed in the dusty pages of a book, his corners shrunken and torn, footless from all the marching. A friend of my grandfather's taught Ulpe to read. For the God's sake of this story, we'll call her Faith. Constance and Rayanne smile when I say, I bequeath myself to the dirt to grow from the grass I love. Then they frowned. Our souls just mush under boot soles, long to be eaten by grassy teeth. Ulpe doesn't recognize my brilliant head, thinks I'm the younger brother. My name nonsense. With the Pacific conquered, Truman took the ones who read and sent the rest packing. When Constance and Rayanne hit the books again, I want to say, faith and belief. A foggy bathroom mirror. A raincoat on the man who drags a suitcase full of dictionaries door to door. Today's forecast, humidity. I heat myself. I heat my hand. I heat the air inside my hand like a handful of warm glass marbles. I can't believe they call me sister anyway when they're just Constance and Rayanne to me. The same as Jing and Sunny. Their pamphlet charges to my sweat and releases a green sore of ink in my palm.
The poetry of Kristen Naka. Thank you so much. It was wonderful.
Thank you so much for having me here, Jan.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.